If you have kids or pets, you know stains and odors in your carpet and upholstery are inevitable. But the experts at ChemDry can help. ChemDry removes odors and stubborn stains by sending millions of carbonating bubbles deep within your carpet. ChemDry lifts dirt, urine, and stains to the surface to then be extracted away, giving you a cleaner and healthier home. Call 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com to connect with your local ChemDry and learn about special offers in your area. That's 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com today.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. With over 350 million global monthly visitors, Indeed's matching engine helps you find quality candidates fast. You get to ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. It's not just about hiring faster, though. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Don't search. Match with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So a few months ago, we had screenwriter and Renaissance man Brian Koppelman on the show to discuss creativity, working routines, facing rejection, and what Brian had to say resonated with a lot of you. We got rave reviews about that podcast. Anyways, Brian mentioned he has a writing partner that he's worked with for pretty much his entire career, that they've worked together on Rounders, The Illusionist, Ocean's 13. That writing partner's named David Levine, and Brian made the introduction, and I had to get David on the show because besides being a screenplay writer, besides being a movie producer and director, David is also a published novelist, and he's focused a lot of his work on the detective genre, which I'm a big fan of, Raymond Chandler and all those classic hard-boiled detective novels. Anyways, David and I discuss creativity, his working routine, how you establish a working relationship with a writing partner or a business partner of any type. We also discuss detective novels and what men can learn from detectives in the detective novel genre, and why the detective has become such an archetype of American masculinity. Besides that, we talk about boxing and MMA. David is a boxer. He's dabbled in mixed martial arts as well for most of his life. And in fact, his grandfather was a professional boxer who fought Joe Louis for the world championship. We discuss what lessons David has learned from boxing and also from his grandfather's experience as a professional boxer in boxing, Joe Louis. Anyway, fascinating podcast with lots of great insights and things you can do to start applying in your life today to improve yourself. I think you're really going to like this, so let's do this. David Levine, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brett. Happy to be on.
All right, so you are a writer. Not only of fiction, but also of screenplays. And you're actually the writing partner of Brian Koppelman, who we've had on the podcast before. And you guys worked on, what is it, Rounders and Ocean's 13 and Walking Tall or some of those?
Yeah. Brian and I have been best friends since we were kids, actually. We met when I was 14, he was 15 or 16 on this summer trip, and we lived near each other in New York growing up. Never went to the same school, but... lived near each other and have been best buddies since then, you know. And a while back, like about 17, 18 years back, we'd each taken these circuitous routes through our careers, and we ended up at this place where we both wanted to write screenplays and make movies. And I had a lot of experience in the business because after college, I moved out to LA and started working in the movie business. In low-level assistant type of jobs, as a reader, mainly of screenplays and a story editor. So I read thousands of screenplays, and, you know, out of the thousands, there were probably a dozen good ones. But I felt like I was able to identify them and understand the form through osmosis by just being there and reading so many of them. And I ended up back in New York and I was bartending. He was working as a record exec, and we decided we wanted to sort of join forces and do a script together. And we started meeting like in the mornings before he went to his job and after I get back from, you know, I'd wake up early after bartending. And we knew we wanted to tell a story about friendship and about trying to find your destiny and all that sort of stuff. And we couldn't exactly figure out what world to set it in. We knew that one of the characters would probably be a law school student, though that wasn't the path he wanted to take. And then one night at like 3 a.m, I got a call and it was Brian, and he'd stumbled into one of these underground poker clubs in New York City and gotten cleaned out, lost every dime he had. But he loved it. He thought it was so colorful and amazing. And the next night we went back and we started going basically every night playing / researching. And we did that for about a year and met all the characters on the scene. And that's when we knew that we'd do this poker movie. And that's what turned into Rounders. And we've been working together ever since. We've been writing partners in the movie world. We've produced a lot of stuff together, and we've directed together as well.
So here's a question I have. You guys are best friends since you guys were kids. How do you collaborate on creative work? Because for a lot of people, I think they think something like a screenplay or a movie, you know, directing, it's sort of like it's the lone artist, the lone genius working by himself. How do you fuse two minds into a story? Right, with the screenplay. I mean, what's your collaboration process like?
Well, you know, you hear about these writing teams and even like 3-person and sometimes even more people on a team, and it is kind of hard to understand how all that can coalesce and turn into like a single vision. But for us, you know, if people would think about the Hughes brothers or the Coen brothers, it would make more sense in a way, as if like, because people are brothers, they have a mind meld going or something. So we sort of say that we're like brothers, but we don't have all the baggage of having grown up in the same house in a way. We, you know, growing up, since we've known each other since we were kids, we've read a bunch of the same books, always we're going to the movies together. So, our favorite movies are pretty similar, listening to the same music. We have like a shared language in a way. And there just seemed to be something like when we started writing scripts, it's a collaborative medium. You know, often it starts with one person alone writing this story and then other people get involved. And, you know, it starts to become all these, you know, a director, camera people, all these crew members and producers and money people and stuff like that. So our thing just starts being collaborative right from the beginning. And, you know, we would be saying the dialogue to each other. So it wouldn't be like the solitary thing where you would picture like an author just in a room alone grinding out this prose. We're writing these scenes that are basically, you know, a lot of these scenes are people talking to each other. So there we are doing it before it's barely written.
That's cool. Well, besides your the screenplay work, you also write fiction, write novels, and detective fiction in particular. You have the Frank Bear series. And I'm curious, because I'm a big fan of like the hard-boiled detective novelists from years gone by, like Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler. Have those guys had an influence on your work?
Definitely. You know, growing up, I would read those books. I love Hammett. I love Chandler. Jim Thompson was a guy who, you know, I read everything he wrote. Lawrence Block, and I've been lucky enough to get to know Lawrence Block over the last little while, which is amazing. Elmore Leonard, I'm a huge fan of. But then other writers too, you know, I was a big Hemingway reader growing up, and I think I read his sort of fancier novels, but when I became an adult, I went back and started reading those short stories, and a lot of them are kind of hard-boiled crime short stories, and his writing style is, you know, really lends itself to that. It's so terse and economical. And, you know, guys like Kem Nunn. So I've been a huge fan of that genre. And I wrote a couple of books sort of at the beginning of my screenwriting career. I published 2. They were more what would be considered literary novels, less genre. But I had this idea for the first one of these Frank Bear books in the series, you know, what turned out to be a series at the time. It was just this one story I really wanted to tell about a kid who goes missing from sort of a place where it's not expected. He's in Indianapolis and the Midwest, kind of bucolic setting where people aren't really ready for that kind of thing. And his father sort of can't let the thing go and accept it, and tries a few times futilely to get private investigators involved, but they don't do any good. And then he happens onto this guy, Frank Bear, who's my character. And Bear takes on this case, and he's got a dark sort of tragic episode in his past that in a way dovetails with the missing kid. And it's sort of haunting to him, but he decides he's going to do it. And he starts getting involved, and he starts finding what he thinks are results. And before long, the father can't sit idly by and sort of forces his way in to work with Bear. And it's sort of a buddy book in the hard-boiled genre where these guys build a relationship as they go to try to find out what happened to this kid. And at the time, I was working in the movie business, and I didn't have a lot of free time. But I had this burning desire to be a novelist and publish books. And I decided that I was going to start waking up super early before I went to work. And I had moved out of New York to the suburbs by then. So I started taking the train to Manhattan, and I stopped driving because that was wasted time, where the most I could do was listen to something, like listen to a book on tape or something like that. And I started taking the train and trying to grab that 40-minute block of time in my life. And little by little, just write one scene a day or, you know, a few paragraphs, whatever I could. And this story came to life. And it turned out well. And I was able to set the book up at a great publishing company, Doubleday. And they made a 2-book deal with me. And the series was launched from there.
Fantastic. And you have another one coming out, right?
I do. I have the fourth one in the series coming out. It's called Signature Kill. And that's coming out on the 24th. I'm excited about it. I've been working on it for a long time. And it is a journey into some dark stuff. Frank Bear, my guy, who's this big brooding guy who works on his own, sometimes a little self-destructive, doesn't build a great career for himself. Sometimes he spikes into a good situation where he can make some money and be on the right track, but he's got a couple of self-limiting or antisocial tendencies that rear up, and he's basically on his own. He's got some financial pressure. He can't figure out exactly how he's going to find cases. And he sees a billboard with a missing young woman on it with a big reward attached. And he knows it's sort of a hopeless case, but he decides to sign on to it. And as he starts working that case of what happened to this girl, he realizes that he's in the middle of a bigger case overall, where lots of people, young women especially, have started to disappear in the city of Indianapolis over the last many, many years, but in a way that it's not clear that it's a serial killer to people who wouldn't be looking or who wouldn't want it to be broadcast. The police sort of don't want it to be known as that because they don't want to create a panic. But he starts to figure out that there might be linkage between what he's working on in this bigger case, and he goes from there.
That sounds like some Dashiell Hammett. There's one of the novels was like that, where the detective will get on a case and he finds out it's actually something bigger. The detective, right? The private eye is sort of has become this archetype of American manliness, right? Because people think of Humphrey Bogart in the trench coat, the hat, the cigarette in the mouth, stoic. Yep. I mean, do you consciously think about like masculinity or manliness when you're developing your characters or how they'll respond to a situation?
Well, it's definitely a manly area, right? My thing is set in contemporary times, so nobody's walking around in trench coats and hats. But there's this incredible legacy. You know, there's something so great about the detective and especially a detective in America, because if you really extrapolate it, then you're talking about somebody who's searching existentially, and they're looking for answers to incredibly complex questions at the heart of these cases, things that get to the heart of our existence that can't really be found out. They can find out facts, and they can put together the way things happened. And that's sort of just a nod at what they're really looking for, which is usually some better description of their identity. There's, in the good ones of these stories, the cases that they're on have a reflection to what the detective doesn't understand about himself. And there's a parallel, a little bit of a parallel journey going on. As the guy figures out what's going on the outside, he's also discovering something internal about himself.
Yeah.
You have these guys in a violent setting, and there's either gunplay or fist play, and there's a lot of, you know, there's criminals who are trying to inflict their will and take what they want in these situations, and these guys don't want it to happen. So it does get very mano a mano.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting too is that the detective is like, he works outside the authority, right? Like, he's usually not a police officer. He works on his own. I don't know, maybe there's some kind of rugged individualist thing going on there.
There is. My character was a cop, and that went badly after a certain point due to certain things that happened in his private life. So there are times in my story, the conflict is always fun and drama. So the cops bitching at the private eye, you know, it just makes for fun scenes.
Yeah.
I try to texture it a little, because there are times when my guy can turn to the police and certain friends that he managed to maintain on the force, and they'll help him a little. There's other times when they'll try to use him and manipulate him in ways that he doesn't know in order to pursue their agenda through an outside person. And there's times when they're both working for the same ends, but that diverges most of the time, and it becomes a problem because the cops want to be the authority in this area, and certain private investigators, hard-headed ones, don't want to listen. I mean, in real life, you've got guys who really work outside of the system. If you think of Pelicano, who's been in jail for a while, you know, he's a classic example of that. He was a totally famous figure in Los Angeles, but he was operating in a way that was more criminal than almost anybody he was investigating.
It's interesting. I'm curious about this. Why there's a lot of talk about how men don't really read fiction, right? Like, fiction sort of like for ladies. Guys like to read biographies and success books or business books. But what benefit do you think men can get from reading fiction? Or why do you think they should make that part of their literary diet?
That's a great question, you know, and I do think that the publishing industry and the book companies buy into that to a certain degree. You know, the book companies have just had much bigger success by placing these female-themed novels in these book clubs, which are somehow largely female. And, you know, the Oprah Book Club was a huge driver of sales for books. And I understand what it's like. You know, guys have a lot of responsibility. They have jobs. They have families to raise. They have a lot of stuff to do. And I suppose that the wrong kind of fiction can seem trifling or a waste of time to them. And they could read a book like Unbreakable or Unbroken, the Zamperini.
Oh, yeah, Unbroken.
Yeah, Unbroken or Lone Survivor. And they get all of the charge of fiction out of that. But it's a true story, and in a way it's inspiring because there's this great courage, bravery going on, and in a way you can graft that into your own daily thing. So I understand it, but I think that there's the right kind of stuff for guys to read that they'll get a ton out of. depending what their interests are. I mean, there's a lot of great writers working these days.
It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now, and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining. On the pants, you can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy-to-follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn the art of negotiation from Chris Voss. We had him on the podcast. Leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest. Writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest. You name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the Masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this Masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. With over 350 million global monthly visitors, Indeed's matching engine helps you find quality candidates fast. You get to ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. It's not just about hiring faster, though. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Don't search. Match with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Yeah, I mean, I love some of my favorite fiction, male fiction writer guys. I mean, they're not specifically male fiction writers, but the guys, the authors who a lot of men gravitate to, I love, like, they're often very ambiguous, right? Like, you don't know, it never ends with, like, a good ending, right? But it leaves you thinking and pondering, like, what would I do in that situation? You know, like, Cormac McCarthy. I mean, I've read almost all of his books, and like they're all like really violent, and they're all sort of like there's like really not a really great resolution at the end, but it leaves you thinking. The same with like the detective novels, you know, so there's a resolution, of course, they solve the crime, but you never, sometimes it's not a happy ending. And for some, I like that for some reason.
Yeah. I mean, the thing, Cormac McCarthy is something you think about. Any guy who would read nonfiction would love to read those books. But you're right. You know, sometimes things are ambiguous, or sometimes because of the writing style, which in his case is very elevated and also very iconoclastic, it's hard to parse sometimes. You know, these passages in Spanish in some of his books, there's no punctuation, there's no quotation marks. And, you know, if somebody's on their way to work or something or has a half an hour to read, that can just be a bit of a pain. For me, it's worth it. This is the area that I live in and toil in. It's sort of natural to me. I know tons of guys went and saw No Country for Old Men when it came out, and I bet you tons of people love that movie, and probably not that many of them read the book, but it's an incredible read.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, weirdly, premium cable, like the
AMC type
stuff. There's some really great shows on right now that have sort of a novelistic style to them. You know, they have these 10 or 12 episodes that are sort of chapters, and it's not cheesy like some broadcast TV. There's no commercials. You can download it on iTunes and take it in a binge or something like that. And in a way, that's supplanted what the detective novels and the noirs used to be for guys in the 50s.
Yeah, Justified, I guess, is a good example of that, or True Detective on HBO.
Yeah, great example. You know, love both of those shows. And you watch those, and you're getting everything that that a really good Elmore Leonard or Mickey Spillane in the old days or whatever, one of those books would, you know, what you'd be going for.
Yeah. I think I've read studies too about fiction helps you become more empathetic, or like builds like theory of mind. Cause like you by reading fiction, you get into the minds of other characters, even though they're fictional, or other people. And it allows you, it sort of builds up like social repertoire in you by reading fiction. I've read somewhere about that.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah. That's certainly why I would do it, because it puts you in a world and it puts you in the head or voice of a person that you would never encounter. You know, really, in a way, it's putting you in the head of an author who, some of these guys have been great thinkers or had brilliant ideas or a great way to express themselves.
So you kind of referred to this earlier when you talked about how you started writing on the train. I'm curious, like, do you have a ritual to get you ready for work, but are you one of those guys like, you know, Stephen King, where it's just like, it doesn't matter what I'm doing. If it's on the back of a napkin, if I'm going to create something, I'm going to create something. Things don't have to be perfect.
Well, I certainly wouldn't compare my output to Stephen King's. You know, that guy is just a phenom. How he does it. I've read some of his books on writing, and I actually can't remember his exact way that he goes about it, but clearly the guy is just a natural. For me, I try to make it less about a ritual, because if you build a ritual, it can be a great way to insulate yourself from actually doing it. You can start to get elaborate with that stuff. You know, you need your room set up in a special way. Nobody can be around. It has to be the right time of day. You have to have the right materials. You have to be in the right mood. You can just basically, if then any part of that isn't right, you're starting to make an exit for yourself from doing the task at hand. You can tell yourself that the ritual wasn't lived up to, so how could you be expected to do your work or do your best work? I try to not be too precious about that stuff. And I get up, I take and read the paper for a little while, get ready for the day, take my kids to school, which is a good time. I drop them off and then head for the train. And it's like a 42-minute ride. And there's something about the fact that it's short that's very freeing, because it doesn't seem too punishing. It's just like, okay, just do whatever happens. How much expectation can you have? Nobody expects you to write 10 pages. You're getting up out of the seat in 40 minutes. So whatever happens, happens. And sometimes I grind out a couple of sentences and end up just staring into space. And other times I have to pack up my stuff and jump off the train before the doors close and they take it back to the train yard or something, because I got on a roll. So that's how my day starts. Now, I'm someone who's fortunate to do what they love, so writing is my day job, or, you know, creating stuff is my day job. So parts of it are long periods of writing these screenplays and teleplays. So I'll end up at my office shortly after getting off the train, and then I'll have a day of writing ahead of me. But the day of writing at times isn't even as concentrated as the 40 minutes, because the phone will start ringing, there'll be stuff to deal with. Brian and I, you know, we could just be like in a different headspace where one of us wants to talk something through and the other one wants to write something down, or one guy wants to write dialogue and the other guy wants to keep going with the outline. So, you know, out of the bigger portion of the day, sometimes you're just looking for a way to capture quality minutes also.
Gotcha.
That's what it is. I remember when I was younger, trying to make everything perfect and clear my day so I could write for hours and cover page after page. And it was almost crippling. And then I read something that Carver wrote about writing, Raymond Carver, great short story writer. And he said he had always planned on being a novelist, but he had kids when he was young, and it was always, he had to be a teacher to make money. And every night it was like he had to help doing the laundry and cleaning the dishes and making his kids lunches the next day. And he realized he was never going to have more than a 45-minute or hour or two-hour patch in his life. And he better write something that he could finish in that amount of time. So he started writing short stories and just gave, you know, forgot about the novels and became one of the best ever.
Wow. So yeah, the constraints helped him.
Yeah. You know, I guess you got to find a way to make these limitations work for you, because otherwise they really are going to be limitations.
Yeah. So this is something interesting about you. Brian told me you have a background in boxing and martial arts, correct?
Yeah. I've been doing that stuff for years. You know, not as a serious, I'm not out there like as a club fighter, or even amateur fighter. I have to protect the mainframe. You know, I'll spar. I'll wear headgear. It won't be too crazy. Generally, I'll be sparring with trainers now instead of guys at the gym. But I've been boxing for a while. I've done martial arts. I do Brazilian jiu-jitsu. I'm into it. It's I love MMA, and I'm getting kind of on the older side for that. I'm 47. But it keeps you in great shape, and it makes you feel like alive, you know. Whenever I go to do some other sport, like tennis or golf or something, it's like sleepwalking. And when you're in there rolling with somebody or sparring, you just really feel alive.
Yeah, so I mean, it's kind of interesting that there's like a lot of those like manly writers, right, that we think of, the iconic ones like Hemingway, Jack London. Both were avid boxers, and I've read there's this guy, he's a philosophy professor. I forgot where, but he wrote an essay. He's a boxer too. How philosophy or boxing has helped him in philosophy. And I'm curious, has taking part in martial arts, boxing, has it helped you in any ways with your like creative and intellectual battles in your work?
It's helped me in numerous ways, I'd say. I mean, for one, any experiential information that I gain by practicing this stuff has been put on its feet in my books, because Frank Bear lives in a world where he's not doing this stuff as sport. You know, he's constantly like, he's living this rough and tumble life as this private investigator. So I can use the details that I've learned for him. You know, he's a guy who is an experienced street fighter, and he's a big, tough guy, and he knows firearms. He knows hand to hand and all that stuff. So there's always scenes in the books that cover it that I get to inform with a lot of real life detail. So that's great. But I think what you're asking is, what does it do on a psychological level?
Yeah.
And, you know, pursuing filmmaking or writing novels is definitely a discipline, because you can only go little by little, and it's daunting, and it takes a long time, and there's a lot of room for self-doubt, and there's a lot of ways that you can get distracted and get off course. Even if you have deadlines, there's always a way you can make up an excuse if you're not careful. So training in these arts is super, you have to be super dedicated. And that's one of the reasons why I keep the sparring or the rolling and jiu-jitsu in there, because that'll force me to keep up the strength training and force me to keep up the cardio, because the downside of not doing those things is so vivid when you go into the third round against some guy who's 25 years old and works in the gym as a boxing trainer and does it all day long. And now, you know, whatever semblance of skill you had starts to fade because you're crapping out and you have no more gas because you haven't been doing your running and lifting and everything. It's a disaster. I mean, you're totally hosed at that point. You're just going to immediately get physical pain as your reward. So it forces you to keep up the discipline. And then that does transfer over, because sitting there and writing a hard scene or doing something, you know, rewriting a book or something, it's just not going to seem as difficult if you've put yourself through the road work and all that stuff. It's a mindset.
Gotcha. Boxing runs in your family. Your dad, or your grandfather, excuse me, was a boxer, and he actually fought Joe Louis for the heavyweight championship of the world. Tell me about your grandfather, and how did that fight go down?
Yeah, my grandfather was, his name is John Paycheck, and the country singer guy, you know, that take this job and shove it guy, Johnny Paycheck, took his name from my grandfather.
Oh, wow.
Took the stage name. But, he was a, he lived on the south side of Chicago. He was super poor growing up. He got into boxing. He was really good. He was the top prospect in the U.S. He fought Golden Gloves for the U.S. He won the Golden Gloves against Ireland and knocked this guy out, broke his jaw. So he was a top prospect when he was like 19 or 20 years old. And he was a heavyweight, but it's ironic because I didn't think he touched 190. I think he was like 188, something like that, you know, very small sort of heavyweight. And Joe Louis wasn't super big either, but he was definitely bigger than my grandfather. So my grandfather was having a really great string of fights through the Midwest, and it was around the time when Joe Louis got drafted into the Army, and they knew he was going to go in like 6 months or a year or something like that. So they organized the Bum of the Month Club, you know, what's pejoratively called that now, where they wanted to book him like a fight a month so he could make a bunch of money before he went into the Army and couldn't fight for a while. So they started to reach out to these likely prospects. And, you know, I've seen footage of the fight, and it's so hard to watch because there's my grandfather, and he gets knocked down three times in the first round. He survives the first round. In the second round, he gets taken out with a left hook, brutal left hook. And I remember talking to him about it when I was young, when he was still alive. He said, you know, when I went in that night, I was dry. I couldn't get a sweat going because I was nervous. And he said, when he hit me with his jab, I felt it. It hurt me. And he said that he'd never been, you know, he wouldn't get hurt by a jab. You get thrown off a little by a jab, but Louis's jab actually hurt him. And before long, it was over. And, you know, I used to always think about it. The thing that I learned about him as a fighter was that he was extremely tough. He didn't become a legend, but he got a shot at a legend. He got pretty close. And the realities of like the fear and the pain, hearing it from a guy who had been in there was totally eye-opening, because as a fight fan, you never actually hear about that. Nobody ever admits that in a post-fight interview. You know, they just say like it wasn't their night or whatever. So there was that side that I learned back in the day. But it's funny, as I got older, one of the first things I wrote, I think the first thing I published was in Ring Magazine, actually. It was a story about my grandfather, and it touched on that fight and stuff like that. But as I got older, I learned something else. This guy reached out to me, an old man who was friends with my grandfather, reached out to me after the article came out, and he told me how the fight came together. And that was a real education in the way the world worked, which was, he wasn't just some rube who thought that he was going to beat Joe Louis. In fact, when the fight offer came in, they said, you know, we want you to fight, I can't remember the date exactly, 1941 at the Garden in June or something like that, Madison Square Garden. And he and his camp said, the kid's not ready. He needs another year. So we're going to turn down the fight. And the promoters strong-armed him and said, he'll either be there that night at the Garden, or he'll never fight in the Garden for the rest of his career. And it was like an amazing firsthand lesson in just how crooked the game has been and how it's always been that way. So I felt, you know, I didn't just feel like he was an athlete who lost. I felt for him as a young man who got bowled into something that was bigger than him, that there was no way he could have actually pulled off.
Yeah, and you just have to take it. You know, I don't know. I mean, that's like, I feel like we've all been in one of those situations where you're sort of forced into something and you just have to make the best of it.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you just find yourself taking it and you just hope you can take it like a man.
Yeah. Well, David, where can, this has been a great conversation. Where can people find out more about your work? And when does the next book come out?
Well, the next book comes out on Tuesday, March 24th, and it's called Signature Kill. And My website is davidlevien.com, and my last name's L-E-V-I-E-N. It's a little unusual spelling, davidlevien.com, L-E-V-I-E-N.com. And all the info's on there.
Fantastic. Well, David Levien, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it.
Our guest today was David Levien. He is a screenwriter, movie producer, and director, and a novelist. And his latest novel in the Frank Bear series dropped last month. It's called Signature Kill. If you're a big fan of detective novels, and if you're not, go pick it up. I think you'll find a new genre of literature you're going to like. I'm a big fan of it. You can find that on Amazon.com. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you'd like to support our podcast and support the website, one thing you do is go to store.artofmanliness.com and pick up some of our Art of Manliness gear that we have there. We've got a fantastic, really manly coffee mug we've gotten rave reviews about. We put a whole bunch of t-shirts on clearance for the spring, so go check out the clearance section. Anyway, some great stuff there. Go check it out. Again, store.artofmanliness.com. Your purchases will help support the continuation of the site and the podcast. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.